It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we continue with the next installment of our six-part series on heroin from WPR News.
We'll also find out why Detroit's deep in the red and what could happen next with our fellow Midwestern city.
But first, we're launching a new segment today called Hidden Wisconsin.
The name's in honor of the book Hidden America by Jean Marie Laskus, which celebrates under-the-radar jobs that keep our country running.
So with Hidden Wisconsin, we want to hear from you. What's your job? Is it something that keeps our state humming along, that normally goes unacknowledged and needs a moment in the spotlight?
Well, joining us now, we have Jean Marie Laskus helping us kick off this segment. She's a journalist and the author of Hidden America. Jean Marie, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, in your book Hidden America, you celebrate professions that we don't normally think about that are still interwoven into lots of aspects of our daily lives. You hung out with cowboys and coal miners and migrant farm workers. Why do you feel it's important that we know about jobs like this and the people who do them?
Well, I think there's just an awful lot about our lives we have learned to take for granted. You know, the people who keep who make our lives really very simple, who work under the radar. I don't know, it's sort of worth taking a moment to pause and wonder, wait, how did that happen? How does this electricity even happen in my house? You know, it's because of a coal miner.
Why do you think we take those things for granted, and why are these people invisible to us?
Well, I think we've taken them for granted for several generations now. It's sort of like, you know, the sanitized way that we live, and it's great. I'm all for air conditioning, you know. But I think couple generations ago, we knew these people, you know. They were our neighbors. They were the person who brought us the milk. You knew the farmer down the road. This is the way we lived a few generations ago, but not so much anymore.
And so that's going to be the point of this segment, Hidden Wisconsin, where we talk to people in Wisconsin who do the jobs that inform our daily lives, but we don't necessarily know their faces, their names, their stories. And I wonder if you could kick us off a little bit by telling us some of the stories that you discovered while you were researching your book. Maybe tell us a little bit about the coal miners.
The coal miners, that was the first chapter that kind of brought this whole idea to light. You know, I happened to get into a coal mine one day and was stunned by the conditions under the ground there. And this guy, Smitty, one of the miners, turned to me and you know, I said to him, I don't think people have any idea what you do down here. And it was his remark. He said, yeah, I don't think that people know pretty much anything about how this whole country works. This was a really tight community of all men living in, you know, this 10 hours a day, tremendously dangerous conditions, in the dark, in a mine that was, you know, 5 feet high. No one could even stand up.
How do you even prepare yourself for something like that? It must take a special person.
It's funny. They told me that there are people, you know, apparently, right the first time you go down, whether or not you're going to be a coal miner or not. You know, you can handle it or you can't, and plenty of people absolutely can't, you know, the conditions and the, sort of the claustrophobia and the darkness and the lack of air, you know, pretty basic matters. And you don't know going down whether or not you're going to be able to handle it. You don't know. And all the bravado in the world won't do you any good. You either can or you can't.
Now, the people we see in the media a lot are the high-profile people in the high-paying, glamorous jobs, the movie stars, the athletes, the politicians, maybe not quite so highly paid, but sort of out there and glamorous. Have we lost a sense that all jobs have a value, have a worth?
Well, I think so, and I guess that, you know, so much of those kinds of jobs or people who are in the spotlight is sort of like a fantasy life. Maybe people want that, or they want to be famous or rich, or you know, all of that is. I don't know what drives that as the thing that we are most bombarded with. But I'll tell you, the people that I spent time with writing this book, that was one of the wonderful things, is like they weren't about becoming rich and famous. You know, they really weren't. They were people who were dedicated to whatever these jobs were that they had.
How did they change your life? Did you think about the world around you differently and the people that you came across?
Oh, absolutely. In many cases, yes. Probably the most striking example was the migrant workers who were, I lived in a camp up in Maine during the blueberry season, you know, just sort of picking our fruit, you know, who are the people who pick our food. And I would say of all of them, that experience changed my life daily more than any. You know, talk about something you so take for granted is how this fresh food gets to your plate, that there are people out there picking it whose fingerprints are on your fresh fruit. And living in this case, you know, in the shadows and in hiding because they were, some were legal, some were not. And that just sort of very distant society, even though it was right there, right on the other side of, you know, Maine vacation land.
You were talking to people who were underground, in some cases literally, in some cases figuratively. How did they react when someone showed this interest that gave them the opportunity to talk about what they do?
In most cases, they were either confused and, like, why? I got a lot of that. Why are you interested in this, you know? But overall, I'd say people were delighted to have someone pay attention to them and to get to talk about what it is they do. They weren't used to talking about it, you know? They just daily, it was sort of like a daily life for them. But it was fascinating to me, you know? Everything was, these jobs were fascinating. Who knows how these air traffic controllers, for example, you know, work all those planes around and get us on the ground safely. I mean, it was crazy.
Did you spend any time in Wisconsin when you were researching your book?
I did not. Not for any reason. I didn't want to not spend time in Wisconsin. Just I didn't have any of the chapters that had to be set, that were set there.
Well, we're going to try to extend the idea you brought up in your book to Wisconsin. Can you help us put the call out? What kind of people would you like to hear us talk about or see us talk to in Wisconsin?
Oh, boy, this is such a great, I love that you're doing this series. I would like, tell me somebody who's out there doing a job that everyone is dependent on and forgets and has no idea. I mean, the mail carrier, for example, or, you know, a grade school teacher. I mean, there are an awful lot of people. It doesn't have to be blue-collar workers. This is across the board.
Sounds like a lot of discoveries that I'm hoping we're going to have along the way. And thank you so much for helping us launch this segment, Hidden Wisconsin. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Jean Marie Laskus is a journalist and the author of Hidden America.
Now, here's how it works. We need to hear from you. What is your unsung profession or your nomination for somebody you know? There's a lot of ways you can get in touch with us. Here are some of them. You can email us at centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime, no dots there, at wpr.org. And why don't you put Hidden Wisconsin in the subject line?
You can also message us on Facebook or call the new Central Time hotline, which is toll free, by the way. It's 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. And, you know, you could be featured on our next Hidden Wisconsin segment.
Looking forward to hearing from you. Coming up, we continue our look at Wisconsin's heroin problem with the next installment in our WPR news series. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Today, in a continuation of our series on the growing problem of heroin in Wisconsin, we learn about a life-saving drug called naloxone, also known as Narcan.
It brings users who overdose back from the brink of death. Naloxone isn't always available, especially in rural areas, but as Kristen Durst reports, one nonprofit is working to change that.
If you're an injection drug user in South Central Wisconsin, you may know or may have heard about a guy named Jimmy.
Hello, LifePoint.
Jimmy is James Ranke. He works for the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin's LifePoint Needle Exchange Program. The program's mission is to prevent the spread of AIDS and hepatitis C, which can be easily transmitted by sharing needles.
Okay, so I'm over by Easttown. I stopped here for someone after Sun Prairie, and then I'm headed your way.
Ranky drives a van around all day, meeting users at their preferred location, where they swap out their dirty needles for free clean needles and other supplies. He stays busy.
Last year, we did 300,000 syringes, and it was over 2,500 stops.
Ranky also carries the drug naloxone, the generic name for Narcan. He hands it out along with a prescription and provides training.
Really, the naloxone is just a muscle shot. So you hit him in the shoulder, you hit him in the thigh, you hit him in the top of the butt. And so you can't miss.
In the event of an overdose, naloxone reverses the effects of some drugs, including heroin and oxycodone. At one of Ranky's regular stops, he provides a refill to a woman in her 40s who doesn't want to share her name. But she says she's used the drug many times on others, and recently it was used on her.
I said to my friends, I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. And that's all I remember. And I guess I turned purple. So Narcan saved my life this last week. And like I said, I've had 5 saves in the last year and a half myself.
ARCW started providing naloxone to users in 2005 at its 9 locations across the state after a rise in overdoses. Scott Stokes is Prevention Services Director. He says since then, thousands of lives have been saved. But the program has its critics.
A lot of people feel like, well, if they're going to use drugs, then they need to suffer the consequences that goes along with it. My only problem with that is, you know, this isn't alcohol, where if you're drinking and driving, you lose your license. If you overdose, you die.
He says they are currently the only source in the state where users can get naloxone. He says physicians could prescribe it, but they don't. And he says without a Good Samaritan law, which would provide immunity to users, many won't call 911 because they're afraid they could face criminal charges. Also, he says there's another reason for the need for wider distribution. Many ambulances don't carry naloxone. In Wisconsin, only advanced life support level services, those that can start IVs, can legally carry the drug. Madison Fire Department paramedic Paul Poker says that's a real issue in the suburbs and rural communities with basic level EMTs.
If you have to wait 15, 20, 25 minutes to get that drug or wait for them to transport you to the hospital, the chances of long-term effects, whether it's brain damage or something like that, can go up significantly.
There is an inhaled version of Narcan that many basic level providers across the country are carrying. The State Department of Health Services, which licenses EMS services, says that would require additional training and a change in law, but that it is under consideration. In the last 5 years in Wisconsin, EMS services who've reported naloxone use to the state have used it over 15,000 times. Kristen Durst, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Kristen. Our series will continue tomorrow as we discuss how, in some communities, heroin is being considered a public health issue more than a criminal one.
And now we turn to Detroit. The Motor City has been struggling chronically with its budget deficit, which is about $20 billion. Some breaking news now. The city of Detroit is currently filing for bankruptcy. We've been looking at that story, wondering when it was going to happen, as have many around the country and, of course, in the city of Detroit. And right now we've got that news, which is that the city is, in fact, filing for bankruptcy, and we're going to welcome to the program Craig Falla. He's a talk show host at WDET and a former reporter based in Detroit. Craig, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thanks very much. Appreciate it.
So, Craig, what do you make of the news?
Well, it's not surprising at all. There are a couple of lawsuits that were expected to be filed on Monday by some bondholders and also pension holders, and by filing today, they can sidestep those lawsuits. All lawsuits are put on hold. So basically, this frees the city up to use some of the revenue it has coming in to keep things going while they reorganize. It had to be done at this point based on the lawsuits that were coming.
Now, this is the largest municipality in the United States to ever file for bankruptcy. What do you think this means for Detroit and how it's viewed by the rest of the country?
Well, the interesting thing so far, though, is that it hasn't stopped a lot of the investment that's been happening in the city of Detroit over the last few years. It's not as if any of this financial news in Detroit is new. I think the scope of it may have taken some people by surprise that weren't paying that close of attention, but there is still investment going on here, and a lot of people are looking at this as if the city is finally getting its act together. They're looking at this as an overall positive. I mean, it's sad that it's gotten to this point, but I think there's a lot of people that recognize that it was time to stop the denial.
Now, what about those who are worried about their pensions being cut with a bankruptcy filing?
Well, that remains to be seen what's going to happen there. I mean, pensions in Michigan law, in the Michigan Constitution, The state cannot cut pension benefits. Now, it doesn't say anything about health care benefits, so it's more than likely that a number of retirees in the city of Detroit, people that used to work for the city, are not going to have a health care plan paid for by the city any longer. Pensions are going to be more difficult. Now, one of the big questions is whether or not federal law and federal bankruptcy law is going to trump state law on that question, and that's something that is likely going to be worked out in court.
Now, Kevin Orr was appointed by the state to oversee Detroit. What is his role in this bankruptcy procedure?
Well, he is technically called the emergency manager in the city of Detroit, the emergency financial manager in the city of Detroit. He basically takes over operation of the community. But when he was first appointed to this position, he came from the law firm of Jones Day, which is a huge bankruptcy firm. In fact, they handled a lot of the bankruptcy for the Chrysler Corporation when they went through. That got the attention of Governor Snyder, Governor Rick Snyder, when this is all going on. And Kevin Orr, who went to the University of Michigan close to the same time that the governor did, got his attention. He saw what he was able to do. And so a lot of us sort of knew when Kevin Orr was brought on that this is exactly why he was being brought here, because this is the area of expertise that he has. He knows how to negotiate with creditors. He knows how to go to court with creditors, frankly. And that's, I think, exactly what the hope was, that this could be as quick as the Chrysler deal.
So how long is the wait to find out whether this is going to go down the way Detroit hopes it will?
Well, that is unclear as well. There was, of course, a case in California, Stockton, California. It took them about a year to go through all the court proceedings to find out whether or not they were even eligible for Chapter 9 bankruptcy, because there will be a lot of creditors that challenge whether or not Detroit is even eligible to file for bankruptcy. In Detroit's situation, it won't take very long for them to demonstrate that they don't have the cash flow to pay off all their obligations. In fact, they stopped paying on some of them just a few weeks ago to pave the way for this filing today. So I don't think it's going to take very long to at least give those in charge of deciding whether or not Detroit's eligible to see that they just don't have the cash necessary to keep going the way they are.
Well, prior to this bankruptcy filing, Detroit was looking at restructuring its debt instead. What do you think tipped it over into the other side?
I honestly think that what happened was the original response to the opening offer from the city of Detroit that was frankly less than 10 cents on the dollar for some of the debt that was owed. That's what he was offering a number of the creditors. They balked at that number because that's not what they've gotten in other municipal bankruptcies, places like Alabama, of course, the county near Birmingham, Alabama. They were sort of balking at that number, but it was pretty obvious that that might be pretty close to what they get in reality. But when the pensions saw what was going on and they sued, then that forced the city to go into bankruptcy. There was not going to be any more negotiation because a lawsuit getting started on Monday of next week would have delayed things even further and caused us to go a lot longer than I think anybody wanted it to.
Now, you said before that people who are watching this is not a surprise, but what is the reaction on the ground in Detroit today?
You know, there's still equal parts anger and frankly, denial. You talk to a number of people that think that there's some sort of financial shell game going on here. They look at this as an opportunity for the Republican-led state legislature and the governor to come in and strip the city of its assets, sell off what they like to refer to as the city's jewels, things like the water department, Cobo Arena, which is already transferred a couple of years ago. But that's what they think is going on here. They think that there's some pot of money that's being hidden from them, when in reality, Detroit has billions of dollars of unfunded pension liabilities and an operational deficit of about $300 million. So it's not as if this could stand much longer. And again, depending on who you talk to, they just want to know how it's going to impact them. You know, for the average person just living in the city of Detroit, this may actually lead to some better services, since it will likely free up some capital for police, garbage, things along those lines. For a retiree or a city worker, they're the ones that are likely going to feel some pain.
Now, Craig, you also said some people are just saying, hey, this is good. Detroit's getting its act together. It's cleaning up its house. And maybe this means that Detroit can look to a future that looks more like Milwaukee or Baltimore, with a sort of a renaissance in terms of the aftermath of failing industries and shrinking populations. Within about 30 seconds, what do you think? Is that going to be the case with Detroit?
Well, like you said, it's already happening. We're seeing a lot of investment here in the city of Detroit, and a lot of people are wondering whether or not the financial situation was going to be an impediment or something that spurred it. And the investment has not stopped, even with all of this news. So I think it's there. They've got a lot of work to do. There's no question about it. There's a ton of work to do in Detroit.
Well, Craig, thank you so much for making the time to talk today. We appreciate it.
Sure.
Craig Folley is our guest now. He was a talk show host and a former reporter based in Detroit. Coming up after Wisconsin News, we'll take a look at the relationship between creativity and dyslexia. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's a lot more to come here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Dyslexia affects millions of people in the United States. Sometimes they're diagnosed, sometimes not.
The condition makes it difficult to read and learn, but our next guest says there's some good news for people with dyslexia and new ways to help them in school and beyond.
And we'll want to hear from you during this discussion at 800-642-1234. Do you have dyslexia or a child of yours, somebody you're close to? Call in and tell your story, how you were diagnosed, how your life was before and after the diagnosis. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email talk@wpr.org. Joining us now is Dr. Sally Shaywitz. She's co-director of the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. Her books include Overcoming Dyslexia. Dr. Shaywitz, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here with you.
Now, first of all, what is dyslexia?
I'm so glad you asked, because so many people misunderstand what it is. Dyslexia is an unexpected difficulty in reading in relation to a person's age or intelligence level. And it's really important for people to appreciate it's not seeing or reading backwards.
And that's exactly why I asked, because I used to have that misconception about it, that you're just flipping letters on the page.
Now, the really, really good news about dyslexia is there's been an enormous amount of scientific research so that we really understand it at a very basic level, which enables us to identify children and adults accurately, and for children particularly, not only to identify them, but to provide what is called evidence-based interventions. That is, just like in medicine, when you're choosing a treatment, we now know and have evidence of which approaches, which methods are effective in helping dyslexic children learn to read. And we also know that dyslexia has nothing to do with intelligence. And in fact, we published a paper in 2010 where we compared reading and intelligence in typical readers and in dyslexic readers. And what we found was really quite amazing. And that is, in typical readers, reading and intelligence were linked. That is, over time, they were like what I call kissing cousins. They travel together and influence one another. And that really is very consistent with what most people think. Well, if you're very smart, you'll be a good reader. And if you're a very good reader, you're probably very smart. That's true, unless you're dyslexic. We were fortunate. We had a large number of dyslexic individuals who we had evaluated. And when we did the same data analysis on those individuals, what we found was so important. We found that if you're dyslexic, your IQ and your reading don't even talk to each other, so that you can have a very high IQ and still struggle with reading. That's why we define dyslexia as an unexpected difficulty.
And that's
so in the go ahead.
That's what seems maybe kind of heartbreaking about this. Before we were looking to diagnose dyslexia, or for people who haven't been diagnosed yet, they might be in school or somewhere and have trouble reading, and the reaction might be, well, maybe they're just not very smart, or there's something wrong with their basic level of intelligence. Did that misdiagnosis happen, I guess?
Well, not only did it happen, but it's happening today. It's so frustrating because we have the scientific knowledge. You know, in many areas, we say, gee, if we only knew more, we could do so much more. So in many areas, there's a knowledge gap. In the case of dyslexia, we have the knowledge. You know, clearly, we'd always like to know more, but we certainly know enough to do much better. So in the case of dyslexia, it's an action gap. We have the knowledge, but our policy and our schools are not acting on it. And we see every day, we hear from so many parents and see people at our Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity that have the most heartbreaking stories. Children struggle, parents go to the school, and schools will, oh, we don't believe in dyslexia. And my response to that is, in the case of religion, you could choose what to believe in or not. But in the case of dyslexia, which has such a strong scientific foundation, it's a fact. And so many children are being hurt by not being identified and not being given the instruction and accommodations that could make a huge difference in their lives. And we've seen far too many children who have not been identified and give up on themselves, because no child enters school thinking, you know, I'm not going to be a reader. We tell our children, oh, wait till you go to school. You're going to learn to read. You're going to love it. And then for no reason that they can explain, they're smart in every other way, they're not learning to read. And instead of being identified and receiving help, they're sort of looked on and told, just as you said, oh, you're not trying hard enough, or you're not motivated, or maybe he's really not so smart. And I'll give you an example. Yesterday, I spoke to a brilliant physician who happens to be, I think, head of cardiac transplantation at the Mayo Clinic, who also happens to be dyslexic. And he told me when he was diagnosed, I think in sixth or seventh grade, he wrote a note to his sister, I hope I'm getting the story right, who was, you know, the real perfect student. And he wrote, once he had the evaluation that showed his high level of intelligence and that he was dyslexic, he wrote her a note saying, see, I'm not stupid.
Oh. And just think of the missed opportunity, though, too. I mean, a heart surgeon, there are actors, there are CEOs with dyslexia. What we would have lost if they'd accepted that, I'm just not very smart.
Right, but you're absolutely right, but that's the tip of the iceberg. We have so many who could be the cardiac surgeon, who could be the John Irving, who could be the scientist or architect, or just a happy person who believes in himself or herself. And our center is trying to do whatever we can to ensure that our policy reflects the scientific knowledge of dyslexia, so we identify children and provide them services. And I should mention that one really wonderful thing that's happened in Congress, there were two really wonderful individuals, Congressman Bill Cassidy, Republican of Louisiana, and Congressman Pete Stark, Democrat of California, who found that they each had a dyslexic child. So they put aside any kind of political differences and thought more of children, and they joined together so that there is now a bipartisan dyslexic caucus in Congress. Pete Stark is no longer in Congress, so Representative Julia Brownlee of California now is the Democratic half of the bipartisan caucus. And we are very, very fortunate to have this, and I would recommend that any of your listeners who have an interest in care or concern about dyslexia, contact their representative, the congressional representative, and tell them to join the caucus.
Let's step into the schools now and say we've got a school that does believe in dyslexia, that says, hey, we've got kids with dyslexia here. We want to help them. What kind of things are there? Give us a taste of what can be done differently.
Okay. First of all, the diagnosis is so important because it empowers the child to know what he has or she has. So when they realize they're not stupid, oh, my goodness, look, you're very intelligent. And they understand the nature of their difficulties. That's really important. The second thing is what we've learned from science is that dyslexia is a problem involving the language system. What do I mean by that? In order to read, you have to be able to connect the printed letters to the individual sounds of a spoken word. So to do that, you have to be able to pull apart a spoken word. So, for example, the word mat, you have to be able to develop the appreciation that mat is really comprised of three sounds, m, a, and t. So that way, when you see the letter M, you could say m, a, t, t, and then blend those sounds together. For a reason we don't know, dyslexic children and adults have a really difficult time developing the awareness of these individual sounds of spoken language. So that affects actually their own language. They have difficulties, even though they know what they want to say conceptually, they may retrieve the wrong word. It influences their ability to learn to read initially and then to read automatically, and it affects their spelling, and it affects their ability to learn a second language. The good news is that there are programs, evidence-based programs, that actually work in teaching a child to read. In 1998, Congress was very concerned that there seems to be an epidemic of reading problems and mandated that a national reading panel examine which methods and approaches are most effective. I was honored to serve on that panel. And in 2000, we presented to Congress the report of the national reading panel. So there's very, very, very good evidence of what works. The key is to identify children early, to work with them in smallest possible groups, and to have the lessons not be 20 minutes once a week or twice, but have them to be 60 to 90 minutes 4 to 5 times a week. And that's an initial investment, but that pays off in the long run so that children fulfill their potential, they see themselves as learners, they don't end up dropping out of school or sometimes even in jail.
We're talking to Dr. Sally Shaywitz. She's with the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. She's written books including Overcoming Dyslexia. And on our Central Time Facebook page, we have a link to a lot of information about dyslexia that her organization has provided.
And we're curious about your story. Do you or does someone close to you have dyslexia? How did it affect your life? And what ways did you find to work around it and work through it? And if you've got questions, you can call with that as well. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll be talking about a new way of exploring the world, geocaching.
Now we continue our discussion about dyslexia with Dr. Sally Shaywitz, co-director of the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. And we'll go to the phones now with Andrea in Germantown. Hi, Andrea.
Hello. How are you guys today?
Good. What's your story?
Well, I was diagnosed with ADHD when I was in elementary school, and I never felt like I had a problem concentrating or any of those things. This is about, late 80s. I'm 31 now. And when I got into, I passed high school, and when I got into college, I started having a really hard time in school. I was never an excellent student, but especially in college, I really did very, very poorly, and just was in the moment of just completely giving up, and just really did not understand why I couldn't conceptualize what was being taught to me. So what happened was I went into a specialist and got what I call academic therapy, and they taught me how to rework and relearn the way that I felt was best for me, and was able to be a very stellar student after that. But I was also then diagnosed with dyslexia. Mm. So it wasn't until I was about 19 or 20 that this actually happened to me. And once I figured out how to learn best for me without medication, I ended up being a Dean's List Honor Roll student. So.
Well, great. A happy ending there, Andrea. Thank you so much for the call. Dr. Shaywitz, do a lot of people report that, a big turnaround, once they figure out what the problem was all along?
Oh, absolutely. A big turnaround psychologically and a big turnaround academically and educationally. And it's very important to mention here that particularly as students go on in school, what we've learned from our brain imaging studies and others, and there's converging evidence, is that we have been able to identify the systems responsible for reading and have learned that a particular neural system in the back of the left side of the brain isn't working as efficiently in dyslexics as it is in typical readers. And why is that important? Because if you're dyslexic, you could be the smartest person in the world, understand at the highest levels, but you're not going to read automatically.
Right,
you'll be able to read, but you'll read slowly. And what we've learned, too, from our and other studies, if that individual is given the accommodation of extra time, that individual can comprehend at the same level as people who are not dyslexic. So this issue of accommodations and, in particular, extra time is critically important. And some people make this mistake of saying, well, if you're a slow reader, you're a slow thinker. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. There are so many people who are dyslexic. One example is a physician at our own university who's in charge of our pediatric emergency room, and she always says, I read slowly, but I can think very quickly, and you have to, you know, in the circumstance of an emergency room. And what we have to make sure of is that when they're younger or at any age, individuals are identified, given the appropriate intervention, but also the much-needed accommodations. Most people who are dyslexic would rather not have to have the accommodations or stay later or have more time. But there's a biologic need for it. They must have it. And while I'm talking, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention a couple of other things. One is that, as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, dyslexia is highly prevalent, affecting 1 in 5. And it's persistent. I always smile when people say, oh, I outgrow it. It's not outgrown. It's lifelong. And the other is it affects every ethnic, every racial, every geographic group in the world. My book was first published in English. It's been translated, among other languages, into Japanese, Korean, Chinese, Croatian, etc. And it affects people at every socioeconomic level. And it's very, very difficult for most people to be identified because schools don't think of it. But in particular to children who are disadvantaged or who are African-American or Latino, and to help society focus on this, our Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity has established what we call the Multicultural Dyslexia Awareness Initiative, MDAI, to bring attention to the fact that there's so many children who could be helped, particularly children who are African-American and Latina, who are overlooked. I mean, it's incredible what happens. We hear all these terrible stories, but it doesn't have to be that way. And actually, we're having our first conference at Yale at the beginning of August, and are going to be honoring the entertainer and social activist Harry Belafonte, who's very dyslexic.
Okay. I want to jump in. We've got a few more calls, a lot of calls actually about this, and we've got Kathy in La Crosse on the line. Kathy, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm a parent of 4 children. My boys had, my oldest son has severe infantile autism and is nonverbal. And I'm struggling with my youngest daughter, who's now in middle school, and they're, you know, joking with me about getting her spell check as soon as possible. But she's, you know, a very profound poet and is really struggling. And I was interested how much research has been done between linking autism with dyslexia in families.
Interesting. Autism and dyslexia. Any link, Dr. Shaylitz?
That's a very good question. I'm not aware of scientific studies of that link. I would think it's more rare than common, and that's the reason it hasn't been studied well.
All right, we'll go to Jacob in Waukesha next. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. I'm in Waukesha here, and I've been suffering from dyslexia my entire life. I was diagnosed fairly young. My biggest problem is to this day, I still can't remember names. In fact, I've forgotten the doctor's name and not sure how to spell it sitting here right now. And numbers, too. You know, as soon as a number is said, it's pretty much instantly forgotten. All throughout school, I have been given the extra time, you know, because I was diagnosed and I told the teacher up front, basically, that I would need that. And I was a B student because of that. but I still have problems, and I was wondering what I can do about the memory issues as an adult.
Thanks for the call, Jacob. What do you think, Dr. Shaywitz?
Well, the memory problems arise primarily because we store verbal information in its phonologic, that sound-based form. So it's difficult for people to often. It's one of the characteristics of dyslexia, having nothing to do with higher-level thinking processes, but to store it. There are methods to aid in memory. And what are you doing now, Jacob?
I am a
Are you
technician.
In school? Are you working?
I'm working full-time. I'm an electrical technician. And in my job, I frequently will be missing something or need to talk to my boss about, what I'm working on. And he'll ask me a question like, so what was that case number? Or what is the number tied to that job?
Gotcha. Jacob, we're running out of time. I'm going to cut you off there. But any quick tips that you might think of?
Yeah,
Dr.
Well, one of the things is there's so much wonderful technology now. So when you're working on things, you could use some of the technology. And we have on our website information about different technologies where you say it. And then when you need to know it, it can remind you. So you can store it by just saying it to the device. And then when you need to remember what it is, you can go back to what you've stored.
Dr. Shaywitz, thank you so much for spending this time with us. Very, very interesting, very informative.
Oh, well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure. And as you can see, this is a really important problem. And I hope people who care about it, parents and those like Jacob, really let their legislators know, let policymakers know how important it is that we have to identify, intervene, accommodate, and find measures that would help someone like Jacob.
That's Dr. Sally Shaywitz. She's co-director of the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. Her books include Overcoming Dyslexia. By the way, we've got a link to the Yale Center on our Central Time Facebook page. There's a lot of resources for parents, for adults with dyslexia, for schools, too. So, again, that's on the Central Time Facebook page.
And coming up, we're going to be exploring a new way of going out and getting involved in the world that's really catching on. It's geocaching. Have you ever been geocaching, Rob?
I have not. It looks pretty cool. It's out in nature, I gather, but it's high tech. I'll admit I'm a little...
There are prizes.
I guess.
or treasures. Yeah. Well, we'll find out how it works. It sounds like a great thing to learn about, especially in these beautiful summer months. So talking geocaching when we come back. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.